Welcome to Forward Thinking, a podcast from Foundation Source. I'm your host, Dori Krieger. Foundation Source is the nation's largest provider of comprehensive support services for private foundations, bringing unparalleled knowledge and expertise to over 1,200 clients across the country. The best ideas in philanthropy aren't always the tried and true. Trailblazing entrepreneurs and next-generation philanthropists are transforming the sector with inspiring ideas and innovative strategies. Join us as we explore the advice, experience, and insight of some of the creative minds shaping our collective future. Ferguson, Staten Island, Baltimore, Charleston, Cleveland. The recent deaths of unarmed young Black men has sparked national anguish and reflection on race and racism in society today. President Obama has called the challenge of ensuring success for young men of color a moral issue for our country. I'm joined in the studio today by Michael Smith, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director of Cabinet Affairs for My Brother's Keeper at the White House. In this role, he manages the President's initiative to address persistent opportunity gaps faced by boys and young men of color and ensure that all young people can reach their full potential. What are private foundations doing, and what can they be doing more of? We'll learn more about the work accomplished through My Brother's Keeper and Michael's deeply personal connection to this work. Michael's background in philanthropy is extensive. He was an appointee in the Obama administration, serving as director of the Social Innovation Fund. Before his work with the White House, Michael served as senior vice president of social innovation at the Case Foundation. He began his career working at several nonprofit organizations, including the Family Center Boys and Girls Club in Springfield, Massachusetts. Michael, thank you for joining me in the studio today and sharing your unique perspective.
Thanks for having me here. I'm excited to talk with you.
Could you tell us why My Brother's Keeper was created?
So the president created My Brother's Keeper in February 2014 at a time when we were seeing some incidents around the country where we were worried about how boys and young men of color were feeling, if they knew that they mattered, if they knew that their country cared about them. The other thing that we were seeing were just startling opportunity gaps. You know, the cornerstone of the president's administration has been about expanding opportunity. You see it in all of the work that we do from a domestic policy perspective. But we were starting to look at some data back at that time that was showing us that Black boys, Latino boys, tribal boys, and certain Asian American and Pacific Islanders were falling startlingly behind their peers. You look at everything from reading at grade level by third grade. You know about the word gap where kids in low-income families are hearing 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers.
Astonishing statistics.
It really is. You look at the fact that 80% of Black and Latino boys aren't reading at grade level by third grade, which is such a fundamental time where you switch from learning to read to reading to learn. Mm-hmm. And when you look at high school graduation rates, we can be happy about the progress that we're making in the country on graduation rates. But for boys and young men of color in many communities, you're still seeing 50% graduation rates or worse. You look at unemployment. And then you look at things like interaction with the criminal justice system. Black boys, for instance, are 6% of the nation's population, but more than half of the nation's murder victims. And we actually just saw a study that came out recently that showed 1 in 2 Black males will have been arrested by the time they're 23 years old. Mm-hmm. And so you look at that shocking data and you realize we've got to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And if you hear the president talk about it, he would say we have to do something about it because we have a moral obligation to make sure America remains a place where you can make it if you try. Also because there's an economic imperative. Mm-hmm. We cannot continue to be a globally competitive United States of America if we just write off a whole generation of young people. We need them producing and consuming at their highest levels. And then lastly is this idea that we have to make sure these kids know that they matter. The president likes to say that there's nothing more important to the future of this country if young people don't understand that they matter and can achieve their dreams.
So you mentioned that the president started this program February 2014. You're coming up on almost 2-year anniversary. What are you most proud of? What's been accomplished that you're most proud of?
So it's so exciting. There is great energy and momentum around the work of My Brother's Keeper all across the country. We have a robust policy agenda for the My Brother's Keeper work. The president created a federal level task force with almost every single member of the cabinet that has anything to do with domestic policy. And they're looking at serious policies across the life of boys and young men of color and other marginalized youth to see what we can do about it. I'm really excited about our place-based work. We have almost 240 My Brother's Keeper communities and 48 states in the District of Columbia that are building cradle to college and career strategies to address opportunity gaps. And they're doing it with urgency. They have taken 180 days to begin implementing these plans. And maybe even more exciting, they're building great infrastructure where mayor's offices, tribal leaders' offices, county executives' offices are working with businesses, the faith community, nonprofits, building task forces and new infrastructure that will make sure this work lasts. And then lastly, on the private sector side, we've seen huge commitment from philanthropy, from business, doing in-kind initiatives, bringing money, bringing resources, bringing expertise to these communities all across the country to make sure that their work can be sustained.
A lot of our listeners are place-based funders, and you talked about how you're in all these communities across the country. How could someone tap into that network? How could they learn more?
There are lots of ways for place-based funders to get involved, and I bet many of them already are. You know, I've had a chance to go all around the country and visit with lots of these My Brother's Keeper communities, and I've seen philanthropy at the local level really step up in a big way. We were recently in Detroit, and Skillman Foundation is leading the work in Detroit. In Boston, the Boston Foundation was one of the first funders to step up and really make a difference. So all over the country, you're seeing this. If you go to wh.gov/MBK, we actually have a list of all of our My Brother's Keeper communities, along with contact information, and they could get in touch, and they should really just call and say, what can we do to help? It's not, as you know, always just about money. Sometimes it's about expertise. Sometimes it's about an extra hand. Sometimes it's about knocking on a door that they can't knock on by themselves, or sometimes it's convening power and making sure the right people are at the table. So I think there's lots of ways that place-based funders can be involved.
Those are great suggestions. You know, the program's almost approaching a two-year anniversary. I think you're approaching or just approached your first year anniversary. Has there been anything that's been more challenging than you anticipated?
So this month marks a year in the White House. I joined the administration in October of 2013. At times it feels like it has been 1 month. At times it feels like it's been 10 years. You know, there are certainly lots of challenges. I think one of the challenges and also an opportunity, but it's the urgency. You know, I have a timer on my phone. I think we're down to 460 days in the administration. And so President Obama is all about running through the tape, but we're not going to slow down. But because of that, we see an urgency on making sure that we spark a fire that can be sustained, that doesn't need to be constantly fanned and flamed by the Obama administration. And so our communities have 180 days to start their work. When the president created the My Brother's Keeper Task Force, he gave the task force 90 days to give him a series of recommendations. He asked the foundations to do the same thing. And people are meeting these deadlines, but we wake up every day to a ticking clock. And for me, I'm really thinking about, is this work set in motion? Do the communities have the support they need? Is this work embedded in such a way that it can be lasting? And so that's something, certainly a challenge that I see every single day. You know, another challenge I would probably see is something that we dealt a lot with in philanthropy, this whole idea of collective impact. We cannot have just the mayor's offices or just the community organization. We all have to come together. We have to own the challenges and opportunities in our community. We have to have shared data. We have to have shared goals, lock arms, and be responsible for this work together. And as you know, that's a whole lot easier said than done.
Absolutely.
And so that's something that we're pushing every day.
I feel the sense of urgency, even when you're talking. And so you have this, the clock is ticking. And you said that, you know, this is a movement that's going to continue on for decades, well after the 2016 election. But what's going to happen to My Brother's Keeper?
So My Brother's Keeper is a movement that will keep moving. One never knows what a new president will do from a federal policy perspective, but the work of the My Brother's Keeper Task Force will, you know, it's embedded, and the policy initiatives that we launch will keep going. Hopefully, the next president will choose to create or sustain a My Brother's Keeper initiative, but we've taken steps to make sure that this work will be independent and sustained outside of the government. So one thing, a group of private sector citizens announced in May of this past year, the creation of something called the My Brother's Keeper Alliance, which is an independent 501c3 organization led by Joe Echeverria, who was the CEO of Deloitte. So substantial leadership, substantial board. They launched with about $80 million. And their commitment is to advance the goals of My Brother's Keeper and to invest in the work of the communities across the country. So that's going to last long after the president leaves office. The president has also said time and time again, every time he talks about My Brother's Keeper, that this is something that he and the First Lady are committed to for the rest of their lives. And the other thing is, I think that's why the My Brother's Keeper community work is so important, because they're creating the type of infrastructure that they're thinking about it for the long term, not just for the Obama administration.
as we see violence and civil unrest continuing in the headlines, have you altered the initiative's course of action in any way?
You know, it's really tough seeing what we see in some of the communities across the country. And we're seeing members of community step up in incredible ways as well. We're seeing young people step up in incredible ways, wanting to do something about it. And from the very beginning, My Brother's Keeper was not about a gut reaction. Mm-hmm. It was about a long-term lasting strategy. And so My Brother's Keeper communities are creating the places and the forums to talk about the tough issues, to talk about issues of equity, of bias, of race, to talk about our key milestones where we know our young people could really succeed or fall off, and think about building long-term plans that will make sure that, you know, we're not responding to the latest powder keg, mm-hmm. But that we're building partnerships, alliances, programs and policies that will make sure our boys, young men of color, and all youth really have every opportunity to exceed well into the future.
At the launch of My Brother's Keeper, President Obama talked about visiting a dropout and violence prevention program at the Hyde Park Academy in Chicago. He said he could see himself in these young men, remarking that, quote, "The only difference is that I grew up in an environment that was a little bit more forgiving," end quote. This work is deeply personal for you as well. Would you tell us a little bit about your background? Was it forgiving?
You know, I was born into circumstances where one probably wouldn't say this kid will end up a special assistant to the president at the White House. Both of my parents were 16. My dad had just turned 16. My mother would have turned 17 a month later. I was born in a poor black neighborhood that has all of the makings of a poor black neighborhood. Your fair share of crime and mm-hmm. violence and challenges. And, you know, certainly a lot of opportunities to fall off track, certainly a lot of opportunities to go the wrong way. And for me, there were probably a lot of reasons that I didn't. I had an incredible mother mm-hmm. who, when I think about this now, can't believe she had the wisdom that she had.
It's
at
amazing.
16 years old, and made a series of decisions like sending me off to a set of good schools where I had to leave my neighborhood. She also got very religious after she became a teen mom, and I was what they call a Pentecostal pew baby, and we were there at church every time the doors opened, 3, 4, 5 times a week, and I know that had a whole lot to do. Another really smart decision I think my mother made is she dropped me off at my local Boys and Girls Club. I think I was 7 years old, and I spent every minute that I wasn't at church or school at the Boys and Girls Club, and when I think about the work that I do, that is probably the biggest opportunity that I had. It gave me a chance to volunteer. It gave me marketable skills. It gave me an opportunity to test things at a young age that a lot of kids probably wouldn't have. But, you know, I still look around and I look at my childhood and I look at the fact that there are a whole lot of my friends who started where I started who aren't here anymore. They're not here because they might be incarcerated, or they're not here because they died way too soon.
And you're a young man, I should mention, because no one can see us.
Yeah.
We're just on, you know, we're audio.
I'd be 36 in December. I'd like to believe I'm fairly young.
I think
still.
You are.
And so, you know, I look at that and I see way too many young people like me who aren't still here, mm-hmm. or who didn't have the same opportunities I had, didn't get that extra push, and constantly found themselves struggling, maybe made one mistake. Maybe, you know, had a child early and couldn't overcome that. Maybe made a mistake that sent them to jail and mm-hmm. ended up back and forth. You know, as you know, Dory, I lost my brother to the violence in the streets when he was only 27 years old.
How old were you at the time? Are you older?
He's 3 years younger than
okay.
me. He's 3 years younger than me. And we share the same dad and a different mom. But we literally grew up down the street from each other, maybe 3 city blocks from each other. And Tori was an amazing kid. You know, we look at these stories on the news and I think they become something that's just in background because we hear them so much. But
right.
Tori was an amazing kid with a bright smile, with a great future that his family loved, made some early mistakes and found himself on that cycle that he could never get off. And, you know, I think right when he was really starting to rebuild his life, he found himself shot and killed in broad daylight in our hometown. And so when I do this work is an honor and a privilege of a lifetime, but it's also out of a place and a sense of deep duty,
right,
and a desire to really make sure that we lessen those incidents and make sure that there are more stories of Barack Obama's.
Right.
There are more stories of Michael Smith's, mm-hmm, who get a chance to make a mistake, who are maybe born into circumstances that are less than privileged, but still realizing that they have unique opportunities and talents and treasures that we've got to take advantage of, that we need, and that we need to give them a hand up and make sure that they can achieve their dreams.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you have just an extensive background, nonprofits, smaller foundations, large foundations, now working with the White House on this huge initiative. I'm wondering about your message to funders, how they should be approaching their work.
So the message to funders is pretty clear. It stems back from my time at the Case Foundation. Before I left, we launched a campaign called Be Fearless, in which we were trying to encourage more innovation and more risk-taking in philanthropy. Because if philanthropy can't take risks, who can? We have a lot of flexibility. We have a lot of opportunities to be angel investors. We used to talk about the Case Foundation at throwing pasta on the walls and seeing what sticks. And I was fortunate to work for Gene and Steve Case, who were entrepreneurs and really enjoyed trying something new. And if it didn't work, saying, okay, let's move on. And so if we're going to have breakthroughs, we're going to have to make some big bets. We're going to have to take some risks. And, you know, I feel like philanthropy, which was started by some of the greatest innovators, mm-hmm, entrepreneurs, and pioneers of our times, and so many pockets have become a bit risk-averse, has become a bit incremental. And I think there's an opportunity for philanthropy to stand up in a big way and say, what can we do with our resources? What can we do collectively to make a difference on these challenges?
Do you see any difference between the way more institutional foundations or the bigger foundations should approach risk taking versus some of the smaller foundations?
You know, I look at it as if you would look at your 401k investments. If you're middle aged, you want to have a balanced portfolio approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
So don't throw all your money towards the latest shiny new object, but maybe save some percentage of it to say, you know what, I got a good gut feeling about that. I just want to try that. I want to see if it works, because if it does, man, could that be a huge new thing? Could that be groundbreaking, you know, on the Twitters and the Facebooks,
right,
that no one knew what it was going to be many years ago. And then you certainly want to have a good portion of your money in the tried and true. And so I encourage people to think about it that way, but leave that room for innovation, leave that room for risk taking. I was actually, I heard a great story from Paula Kerger, who is the CEO of PBS,
mm-hmm,
and she spoke at a Social Innovation Fund conference, and she said the reason that PBS has really remained current and is actually, breaking all sorts of ground in the digital space is because they cordoned off a little team that was the innovation team, who didn't have to come to the regular staff meetings, didn't have to do the 5-year strategic planning process. Their job was just to make stuff and try new things and see what works. And she really credits that team for their success and really staying at the cutting edge. And so I think there's lots of ways in all of our work that we can think about innovating and trying new things. I would say, though, as the former director of the Social Innovation Fund, while you have to keep room for innovation, you can't forget about evidence.
And this is what I was going to transition right to, that, because I know that you're a big proponent of making sure you're retrieving results, like really asking, like, what is this going to do?
Yeah, it's so important. We live in a country where we donate millions and millions and millions of dollars a year to nonprofits, where 1 in 8 spend $0 on research and evaluation. More than 50% don't have a theory of change or logic model. And the federal government, less than 10% of the programs that we invest in the social space, have any real rigorous evidence. And so we have to stop being satisfied with the number of people we served or, you know, the anecdotal story of success. And we have to really realize that good is not good enough. And we have to start measuring to see if there's real impact. Not how many kids went through a program, but how lives were transformed. Not how many resumes were written, but how many folks who didn't have jobs now have jobs, kept them 2 or 3 years out. We are in a great space where we know what works, but we have to stop falling for the emotional, the anecdotal, the billion served like McDonald's, and,
right,
and really invest in impact. And philanthropy is just as guilty as the government is just as guilty as you and me when we write our checks at the end of the year at,
right,
you know, 11:59 on December 31st.
And so when I'm gathering this evidence, how do I know when it's time to walk away?
That's one of the toughest questions. And so you have to build that in from advance, and you have to give yourself a product timeline. So maybe we'll try this for 2 to 3 years. If we don't achieve X result in 2 to 3 years, then it's time to walk away. I always think about the business sector, who certainly innovates. I think spends 20% to 30% of their money every year on research and development. But you see that Clear Pepsi came around, they tried it, it didn't work, and it went away. So there are these things that the private sector tries all the time, but they have a small percentage of the product. They might test it in a couple communities. Look at McDonald's recently, with their all-day breakfast. They didn't just say, let's do all-day breakfast everywhere. They tested it in a few key markets, and they saw if it worked or not. And there are ways that we can think about that with philanthropic capital as well.
We often see, though, with our listeners, private foundations, that they've been giving to a certain organization for years based on family obligation and ties. It seems to me that it's hard to have that discipline to know when to walk away, when at the same time honoring maybe the founder's interests. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah. So what it was Einstein's quote, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So often philanthropy, we wouldn't even know because we're not even measuring.
Right.
And so actually data makes this conversation a lot easier. If you open your conversation with a grantee saying, here are our metrics, here's what we need you to achieve, here's what we're going to look for in year one, year two, year three, we can talk about course corrections along the way. It makes those conversations a whole lot easier instead of, thinking about how many kids did you serve or did you run that program. And so it makes that conversation a whole lot easier.
So, Michael, thank you for sharing that story with us and the work and challenging funders to be more risk takers, gather more data so we can be more impactful and know when to walk away, which seems to be one of the hardest things to do. So thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
To learn more about this segment of Forward Thinking and our work at Foundation Source, please visit our resources page at foundationsource.com. While you're there, tell us what you thought of this segment and who you'd like to hear in a future one. We'd love to hear from you. Our podcast is produced by Gabrielle Galanek. I'm your host, Dori Krieger.